The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to learn about the hidden world of cave dwellers. Now, John Bartlett's article appeared in the August 2025 issue of National Geographic. As one photo caption explains, for centuries we've sought shelter underground. But today, this ancient way of life is under new threat. What can we learn from the last subterranean societies before they disappear? Well, let's find out as we now go to the story in the National Geographic. Nearly a decade ago, documentary photographer and National Geographic explorer Tamara Marino was driving a camper van through the hot and seemingly desolate expanse of Australia's Simpson Desert when one of her tires blew out. The nearly 70,000 square miles of barren red dunes are not a place you want to have your car trouble. Well, summer temperatures push into the 120s, and the water is scarce. Marino coaxed her van down the road and began to see signs of a town, but there was no one in sight, and the few buildings felt abandoned. Wandering the streets, she spotted a rudimentary metal cross on a hilltop. She scrambled up to take a look and found that a wide courtyard opened up below, forming the facade of an underground Orthodox church. Marino soon discovered that she was in an opal mining outpost called Cooper Petey. After a gold prospector discovered an opal in the area in 1915, miners flocked to the region to cash in. When soldiers returning from World War I joined the craze, they began living in dugouts excavated from the hillsides to escape the extreme daytime temperatures. It was a novel idea that stuck, and today much of the community of 2000 lives underground. The people there are so deeply connected to their environment, Marino says. She stayed for a month, captivated by this unusual way of life. The practice of humans living in caves dates back millions of years to when our early African ancestors began taking refuge in underground caverns. Over time, they became more than that. As people added rock art and held communal ceremonies, they became homes. After visiting Cooper Petey, Marino realized that in some places this ancient lifestyle still endures. Exactly how robust these communities are is hard to quantify. In the early 2000s, some 30 to 40 million people lived in underground in Yadong, homes carved into the hillsides of Shaanxi Province in central China. But according to a 2010 estimate, that number had fallen to around 3 million as the population urbanized. Some communities have abandoned their subterranean homes entirely. In the 1300s, the Yadong people lived in caves along the Bandiagara cliffs in Mali to escape religious conquest and slave traders. But over the centuries, the threats receded, and they abandoned their rocky abodes and moved into villages in the valley. Whatever the tally, it's clear underground living is becoming increasingly rare. Over the past 2 years, Marino traveled the world to seek out the remaining practitioners of this dwindling way of life to discover the advantages their enduring tradition provides. The subterranean world is a continuous lesson in sustainability and circular economy, says Pietro Lariano, a climate-focused architect and UNESCO consultant who studied cave populations. It also teaches us a different symbolic relationship with space. Today we have forgotten the importance of the hidden, the unseen, the underground, he said. And indeed, from a small pocket of Mormon fundamentalist in Utah to a town of more than 3,000 in southern Spain, Marino found that while life in these communities seems more precarious than ever, they have much to teach us about human ingenuity and resilience. And now the next part of her story is actually done in four parts, and we're going to begin with part one. And it's in Tunisia, and the headline reads, "The Holdout Staying Cool as Tunisia Heats Up." For thousands of years, the Imazighene, also known as Berbers, in southern Tunisia, have built their homes by chiseling into the low-slung sandstone hillsides that run through the wide plains of the Sahara. These cave shelters offered a cool escape from the searing heat and harsh desert winds. Then the national government suggested there might be a better way to live. It all started when Tunisia gained independence from France in 1956, and the new president, Habib Bourguiba, began pushing for the country to modernize, which meant moving cave-dwelling Amazighene into government-built housing above ground. The people were promised cheap running water and electricity, though many who relocated soon found that it wasn't the case. "They lied to us," says Sliman bin Masoud, a 72-year-old who was born in a cave but moved to one of the government settlements in the 1970s. "They took everything from me and gave me nothing in return," he said. Other attempts at relocation have been somewhat more successful. After a flood destroyed many of the homes around the Matmara and Hadish in 1969, residents were offered land at nearby New Matmara for 3 dinars, a dollar, a square meter. For many, it was an offer too good to pass up. Today, there's one main road through the town, lined by a string of packed coffee shops, a butcher, and an arcade with a few gaming consoles set up in front of flat-screen televisions. But the town still fails to address the one problem the cave homes solved thousands of years ago, the heat. Tunisia, like much of the rest of the world, is heating up at an alarming rate, and temperatures are expected to rise by as much as 11.7 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. "You could have brought modernity to our traditions, but you can't do the opposite," says Ali Kael, 59, at his empty roadside cafe, staring out over the moonscape of Hadish, where he was one of more than 1,000 people born and raised in the hundreds of cave homes on the valley floor. He remembers how, when he was a child, the smell of food drifted between the caves, which would house 2 or 3 families each. People started to move away in the 1970s, and the area has been abandoned since the 1990s. Kale says that the state never contemplated protecting his way of life, and many of those who moved out of the caves came to regret it. Those who have stayed have found clever ways to meld the benefits of their ancient homes with modern living. 8 miles from New Matmara, the Hamadi family live in 5 rooms, dug deep into the sandstone hillside of Beni Aissa. Their home, one of just a dozen or so still occupied in the town, is accessed via an above-ground brick foyer that bakes in the Saharan sun, but the living areas beyond are comfortable and cool. A complex system of water channels and walkways, engineered over centuries, connects the 2 dozen homes pocked across the desert. When it rains, the channels flood gardens of palm, almond, and olive trees. Inside the Hamadi's house looks much like any other 21st century Tunisian home. The walls of a small pantry are adorned with shallots and garlic. The floors in the main living area are lined with pillows and throw rugs. When eldest son Salim, 20, hooks up his phone to a copper antenna, the cave has patchy internet, and Lila, 15, the youngest daughter, can record TikTok videos in a whitewashed storeroom. Grandfather Ali, 73, the family's oldest member, was born in the cave and has lost count of how many generations came before him. "I will never leave here," he says. Lila and Salim aren't thinking of leaving either. They're making plans to dig further into the porous rock. Next, in part two, Jordan, the tribe preserving a connection to the land. The city of Petra was carved into the sandstone cliffs and canyons of the Jordanian desert over 2,000 years ago in the dazzling capital of Nabataean Empire. But for more than 2 centuries, Bedouin, who have called these labyrinth of catacombs, passageways, and chambers their home, it was a bucolic and pastoral existence. The slopes below the royal tomb used for agriculture, and the tribe herded their goats through the long canyon into the city. It was the perfect spot until the 1970s when the Jordanian government made plans to convert the site into an archaeological tourist attraction. King Hussein bin Talal brokered an agreement for the 140 Bedouin families to leave, and officials built towns nearby to house them. Essentially, it was justified as preservation of the monuments as well as establishing new employment and subsistence opportunities, says Mikhail Bila, a professor of ethnology at the University of Copenhagen and author of Being Bedouin Around Petra. By 1985, most of the tribe had vacated the ancient city, and Petra was named the World Heritage Site. The Bedouin who remained, some 120 of them, were moved from the main archaeological areas to a peripheral valley, where tribe members have made use of whatever space they could find. What were once Nabataean tombs have become storerooms, and ancient halls now house tractors, pickup trucks, and camels. Raya Hussein Suleiman Samihan was born in the royal tomb when her tribe had free reign over Petra. Now aged 90, she lives in a row of caves cut into the red rock of the adjoining valley. A kitchen with a wide fire pit and blackened walls, a bedroom dimly lit by lights powered from a solar panel, and a wardrobe cave where her clothes and scarves are hung on a string suspended between two juniper tree branches. On a dusty hilltop several miles from the valley, the government recently built a modern village with the intention of rehoming Petra's remaining residents. Some cave dwellers are ready for a new way of life. Haniya Suleiman Ali Samhin, 37, wants her 8 children to be closer to the school and have permanent access to fresh water, which currently trickles on a tap or out of a tap on the valley floor just once every 3 or 4 days. Others, though, will never leave Petra for a life of concrete and modernity. We like the open air, says 18-year-old Suleiman Samahan, the nature and the freedom. As the sun sets, Suleiman's mother sits on a stone slab outside her cave home, tending a fire. Nearby, Suleiman and his brothers cook mansaf, a traditional dish of lamb and yogurt, in a sand-filled pit that once held Nabataean wine. When night falls, the family will lie outside on mattresses and animal pelts underneath the stars. Taking the Bedouin out of Petra is like taking the spice out of a dish, says Raya. You're left with nothing. And that carries us to part 3, Lesotho, a home for the homeless. The cave at Ha Kone has been a place of last resort. In the early 19th century, a Basotho chief named Kome led his tribe into the Malate Mountains, fleeing a period of war that displaced millions of people throughout southern Africa and led to countless deaths. Kome came across a vast east-facing cave surrounded by steep valleys and mountainous plateaus and set up camp. The location was strategic for security reasons during those times, says Joshua Chikawa, a senior lecturer in the Department of Historical Studies at the University of Lesotho. Members of Kome's tribe, were able to shield themselves and, critically, their livestock from the violence. Eventually, the tribe built individual homes within the Hakome Cave, molding 6-foot-high domed huts from sticks, mud, and dung before smearing orange clay around the low doorways. Locals dubbed the cave Mahalapani, or Palate, imagining it as a huge open mouth. At the turn of the 21st century, 33 of the Kome's tribal descendants still lived in the huts beneath the rock. Over the past 2 decades, nearly everyone has moved to a cinder-blocked village constructed on the bedrock above the cave, where the homes are basic but provide little comfort, like glass windows, and are more pleasant than the huts within a cave. But the Malapani is still a place in refuge and security from those in need. Stefani, a 41-year-old farmer, can't afford to build a home in the village, so he lives in the cave, sleeping in a bundle of animal skins and washing his clothes in the Puishana River, which flows past the cave's mouth. He sweeps the dust out of his house with a straw broom and shovels it into a small fire grate where an old teapot sits over the flames. Inside, he has a few empty candle holders set on a shelf in the corner, and 3 leather suitcases are stacked beside buckets and washbowls. Adjacent is Sebastian Kutz Asani, 58, who is using the one-room hut where he raised his children. It's a quick solution to a temporary problem. His daughter-in-law is visiting from South Africa, and he's given her and the family his home in the village. The men wake each morning with the sunrise as copper-pink light bathes the rock. The only shade comes from the Lekatasi tree, a small, wild variety of wild peach, which, according to local lore, was planted 2 centuries ago by Komi to ward off lightning strikes. Soon Huts, Kutsoni's daughter-in-law, will head back to South Africa, and he'll move up to the village. And Nefani says he'll build a house of his own when he can afford it. Until then, they make do with their home beneath the Malhalpani. Now part 4, Turkey, the dwelling that checks all the boxes. The volcanic landscape of Cappadocia in central Turkey has eroded over millennia to form mountain ridges, sandstone valleys, and rows of Gaudiesque cones that the tourism industry likes to call fairy chimneys. Over 4,000 years, humans too have carved the porous rock, excavating a warren of caves, tunnels, and passages. Among 205,000 acres of archaeological sites in the region, there are dozens of abandoned underground cities. One, Kemakali, is over 4,000 years old and extends 8 stories below ground, complete with stables and wine cellars. Another, Derinkuyu, was vast enough to have housed 20,000 people at once. While these larger archaeological treasures haven't been occupied in more than 100 years, many of the individual homes carved into the area's rocks are still in use. Okte, 72, and Hunife Turun, 64, have lived in their cave home in the hilltop town of Ortahisar since their wedding day more than 4 decades ago. They are one of maybe 10 families left living full-time in a cave in all of Cappadocia, and they love it for a simple reason. It satisfies all their needs. The home has plumbing and electricity. The living room stays warm enough in winter, while the adjoining storage room, separated by a thick rock wall, maintains a stable, cool temperature that allows them to eat summer crops all year round. Rows of amphorae hold bulgur and lentils, harvested 5 seasons ago, and walnuts and fresh fruit are stacked on silver trays. While the Turuns have always seen the value in their cave home, the rest of the world has started to take notice, too. Nearly 5 million people visited Cappadocia in 2023. This tourist boom has prompted many locals to convert their cave homes into shops and hotels and ancient storehouses into the underground restaurants and bars. Recently, one of the Turuns' neighbors sold his cave to hotel developers, leaving the couple completely surrounded by tourism projects. Now, when they duck into their cave, they're met with the low throb of a drill shaking the floor and trails of fine dust dropping from the ceiling. Okte and his Hanifi son, Rifat, 45, grew up playing hide-and-seek in the maze of carved churches and catacombs beneath the family home. Now, like almost everyone here, he works in the hospitality industry, driving visitors from all over the world from one attraction to the next. The steady advance of tourism in Ortahisar is likely to force the family out before too long. If we have to leave, we will sell everything and end up living just like everyone else, says Hanifi. Tears welling up in her eyes. Many of those who've moved out of the caves around Cappadocia have ended up in the city of Nevşehir, where squat apartment blocks with double-glazed windows and enclosed balconies crowd basketball courts and shops. Living in an apartment is like jail, says Hanifi, as she rushes about her house, filling bowls with fruit and vegetables from the storerooms. While she skins a plate of green onions into a tray, fresh milk from the family's 2 cows bubbles on a stove to make cheese. When I open the door, I need to breathe fresh air and see the valley, she says. Well, from the underground or below ground existence of cave dwellers, we're going to head, of all places, to Alaska, yes, where scientists are learning about the extreme birding at the edge of the world. Yep. Tom Klein's article is found in the August 2025 issue of National Geographic, and as the editors explain in one caption, how an abandoned military station in Alaska became an unlikely hotspot for seabird research and a proving ground for the young scientists who spend their summers there. So, let's go find out about this story. For decades, Middleton Island was little more than a forgotten outpost, a flat sliver of land battered by the restless winds and waters of the Gulf of Alaska. In the late 1950s, the U.S. Air Force built a radar station on the remote island to scan the skies for Soviet bombers during the Cold War. The facility was shuttered just 7 years later, its squat buildings and steel towers left to rust. Today, the qualities that made Middleton perfect for military surveillance, isolation, bird's-eye views, and the absence of human distraction have made it ideal for a new kind of outpost. Amid the dilapidated Air Force structures, small crews of scientists arrive each summer by air taxi to turn this ghostly military complex into a frontline research station for seabird science, where radar once scanned the skies, cameras now monitor nests. Where airmen once stood guard, researchers peer through observation ports, studying the delicate interplay between marine life and climate, using birds as a window into ocean health. Birds are a barometer, says wildlife biologist Scott Hatch, who founded and directs the Institute for Seabird Research and Conservation. Seabirds, particularly kittiwakes, are sensitive to environmental changes, so they reflect the conditions and health on ocean ecosystems. Hatch first visited Middleton in 1978 with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and started the IRSRC, which partners with universities to run the monitoring program, in 2009. Changing open temperatures, ocean temperatures, and currents can reduce fish populations, making it harder for birds to find food and successfully raise chicks. When food is scarce, birds' reproductive rates decline. Because seabirds accumulate pollutants like plastics, heavy metals, and oil as they eat and preen, they are useful indicators of contamination levels in marine ecosystems. Like the birds they study, graduate students and other budding scientists arrive at this avian crossroads from different parts of the world, drawn by the opportunity to explore the mysteries of seabird behavior and ecology. Under nearly 24 hours of daylight, researchers immerse themselves in the demanding work of documenting the lives of birds and piecing together the deeper story of the forces shaping life in Earth's oceans. The centerpiece of the research is the old radar tower, repurposed as one-of-a-kind seabird observatory. In 1993, Hatch and his growing team began to outfit the tower with artificial nesting platforms to house black-legged kittiwakes and pelagic cormorants. Now, observation ports allow scientists to monitor every stage of the bird's development. The setup lets scientists conduct controlled experiments that would be unfeasible elsewhere. By tracking differences in feeding behavior and parenting success, they can gauge the impacts of environmental changes on seabird populations. These long-term studies have turned Middleton seabirds into sentinels of ocean upheaval. When the 2014 through 2016 marine heat wave hit, seabird diets revealed a crash in fish, triggering breeding failures and the death of an estimated 4 million common murres, or about half Alaska's population of the birds. The scale dwarfed even the Exxon Valdez disaster, making it perhaps the largest single-species wildlife die-off ever documented, and a stark warning that climate-driven ecosystem shifts can be fast, brutal, and possibly irreversible. While the Seabird Tower offers a bit of luxury for its avian inhabitants, island life for the researchers is decidedly more rugged. You're pooping in outhouses and bathing in pond water that you heat on the stove, says Morgan Benowitz Fredericks, a biology professor at Bucknell University who spent seven field seasons on the island. And you're covered in bird poop and fish guts and blood all the time, he adds. Despite, or perhaps because of, these challenges, the researchers forged strong bonds. Evenings are spent together in the chateau, a former military building that serves as the island's kitchen, office, and living room. Meals are shared ritual with spirited conversations around a long dinner table. In between the many hours of field work, the researchers enjoy moments of play, ultimate frisbee, beach volleyball, guitars, and bonfires under the never-ending twilight of Alaska summer nights. After three seasons on the island, I can confidently say the place is sacred, says former crew leader Sierra Natsone Pete. I think about it every day, the cool science, the grueling physical days, and the lifelong friends I made. Middleton humbles people in the best ways, she says. Well, quite a story there, okay. Well, we're going to end our journey today with another little interesting article here. And we got to turn to it, so just give us a moment. We have to turn. It's easy to turn forward, but sometimes you got to turn back, right? Here we go. We're going to wind up with the future of data storage, DNA. Now, the writers are Diana Marks and Patricia Healy. Their articles from the August 2025 National Geographic. And we're going to see what they've learned from their explorations of how to store all the information we gain every day in our busy world. The future of data storage is DNA. And it says, eons ago, revolution invented DNA to store vast quantities of information. Now scientists think a similar technology could offer a solution to our fast-growing data storage dilemma. The world produces a tremendous amount of data, some 400 billion gigabytes every day, and a number that's increasing rapidly. Most of it is stored in the cloud, which is a pretty word for a network of millions of computer servers and air-conditioned warehouses that transfer and save our data to the cassettes of magnetic tape. But the cloud demands huge amounts of space and energy and has heavy impacts on the environment. The magnetic tape also degrades, needs to be recopied, and requires frequent updates. Enter DNA, the tiny molecule that stores our genetic information. Scientists have come up with ways to mimic DNA artificially to meet our escalating data storage needs. The secret lies in translating binary code of ones and zeros into the chemical bases that make up our genetic code. As the future of innovation will require massively more data, we'll need more sustainable ways to restore it. Now, this novel solution takes up almost no space and can last for millennia, keeping human knowledge safer than ever. Will it totally replace the cloud? Well, not yet. For now, the technology is being developed for long-term storage of things we don't frequently access. Think medical records or library archives, for example. Now, cost and processing times are going down, and experts are working on scaling the technology. The revolution is expected to accelerate over the next decade, upending data storage as we know it. And it's kind of interesting how all this works. There's a good graphic that says scientists and engineers can convert entire libraries into microscopic threads with the help of specialized laboratory equipment. And it shows how they do this using these zeros and ones. There are bits in the bases. So a lot to learn as we move forward in the DNA world. And that, my friends, is going to bring us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org, and take a look at the many podcasts that we do offer there. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.